Hi, I'm Martin Wall, and this is the Climate Diplomacy Podcast. The rise of populism is one of the big stories of our time. Populist movements are gaining momentum around Europe and across the world. One area where the impact of populism has been overlooked is how it affects climate policies. With the European Parliament elections coming up and populist parties set to gain, this relationship will be critical in shaping future climate policy in the EU. A new report by Adelphi shed some light on this complex and dynamic relationship between climate change and right-wing populist parties. I sat down with the authors of this report, Alexander Karius and Stella Schaller, to explore the issue in more depth. Welcome to the show today, Alexander and Stella, and congratulations on what is an excellent and well-written report. My first question is to you, Stella. Can you explain what is populism and what questions you're trying to answer with this report?
Populism is an ideology that essentially considers society to be separated into two homogenous groups. On the one hand, the pure people, and on the other, a type of corrupt elite, and that argues that politics should be an expression of the will of the people. And then coupled with nativism and authoritarianism, it becomes right-wing populism. And we should be worried about it because climate change isn't solvable at the national level, and emissions don't really respect national borders, and therefore multilateral climate action is really required to facilitate collective action on these problems. And the questions we were trying to answer with our report is how rising populist actors across Europe see climate science, what arguments they use against climate policy and what type of frames they use. And further, we wanted to create a first empirical body of evidence on voting behavior in the European Parliament to assess the risks and also come up with potential strategies to deal with those developments.
So I think one of the strengths of the report is that it provides a nuanced picture of right-wing populist parties and their approach to climate change. It's not so simple as saying that all right-wing populist parties behave as, for example, climate skeptics. Alexander, can you explain some of your findings in this regard and how it builds up this complicated picture of populist parties' approach to climate change?
I think what we have done is, as Stella said, looking at the different party programs and statements and voting behavior, we came up with a typology of three groups. One that can be characterized as climate denialists and Eurosceptics, one which is a larger group of 11 parties, which has an ambivalent and not yet really defined position on climate policy, and one or more proactive, progressive perspective on climate and environment issues. And to the first group of the denialists belong the Austrian FPÖ or the German AfD or the Sweden Democrats. They, and UKIP predominantly, most of them are climate denialists. They just don't accept climate facts and climate science. Even within that group, they do not vote consistently against all the climate and energy packages. So you have exceptions here, and I think that's typical for the entire package of the 21 parties we looked at, that it's quite diverse. It's diverse over the entire spectrum, and it's diverse within. So that's the climate denialists. And most of these parties, like UKIP and AfD, these are the big ones. And even if UKIP is not going to be re-elected in the European Parliament, the other stronger ones are going to increase. The second group, they have either a more cautious approach of that, more diversified approach on that, whether they are anti-multilateral climate, but at the same time, some of them are proactive nationalist environmental protectionists. So it's quite diverse picture, and it's not that we say it's that you can neglect that group. Probably that's the most important one when it comes to coalition building, when it comes to network among right-wing populist parties. And the third one is particularly amidst the right-wing parties from Finland, Hungary, and Latvia, where Hungarians Fidesz is an interesting example, because they vote in favor of all the energy and climate packages. But I think that's the crucial thing, that at the same time, they frame their view on climate policy and environment policy very much from a domestic point of view.
Perhaps, Stella, you could build on that a little bit. So how do populist parties who have a very national outlook align their interests with something that requires an international response? So we had the example there of Fidesz, who may be quite proactive on climate change, but also see it more in terms of a national policy gaining energy independence.
The narrative of right-wing populist parties mostly sees climate policy as an attempt to protect the interests of an economic elite. And climate policy is then portrayed to lead to higher energy prices and to burden low-income consumers and companies. And policy is considered harmful to domestic industry. And that fits very well to the anti-elitist attitude of a lot of populist parties across Europe. And what Alexander mentioned is that a number of parties is quite favorable towards climate policy, in particular because a lot of climate policy measures, such as the promotion of renewable energy, can promote energy independence. An example would be the French National Rally that seeks to expand the wind and solar across France, because it would make them independent of Gulf countries such as Saudi Arabia. Another example is the Austrian FPÖ that promotes renewable energy to create jobs and promote the local economy, which chimes with the national rhetoric those parties use.
So, Alexander, you warn in the report that the European Parliament currently has 151 members out of 751 who are openly critical or hostile to the EU. Projections suggest that this group would grow after the election in May. But given what Stella has just outlined, that doesn't necessarily mean that the EU will become more climate skeptic.
I hope that the EU is not becoming more climate skeptic. But I think it's interesting if recent polls suggest that between 22 to 25% of newly elected parliamentarians come from the right-wing spectrum, so one-fourth of the parliament. And you look at seven of the right-wing populist parties being represented in EU governments, I think that could be a toxic mixture of the future legislative packages in the European Parliament or at EU level, where we have a co-decision procedure by the Council and the Parliament. So that is one thing. I think the other question that drives me is what kind of narrative and what kind of understanding about society is coming into the European Parliament, because Stella mentioned that the way they frame climate policy is anti-elitist, anti-science, but also it's anti-democratic institutions. I mean, it's a bunch of Eurosceptics ending up in the European Parliament, one of the very few or the only European institution that is based on election. And one can say, and that's what we learned during our presentation of that study in the European Parliament, that some people say and some parliamentarians say that we have a robust foundation for climate policy based on the decisions that the Parliament took already with the 2030 and 2050 packages, and now it is up to implementation in the EU member states. But it's particularly, and this is where I disagree, now part of the member states to take necessary action. And necessary action not for incremental change, but transformative change that translates everything. The economy, the mobility sector, production and consumption into something that is low carbon and sustainable. That's a long way to go. And I think many of the measures that we could imagine from a climate policy perspective would make sense need to be embedded into a larger context of just transition, social welfare, managing economic transition in the member states. And that's not going to be easy. And I think the battlefield is going to be the European Parliament, apart from the domestic land.
Is there a danger that centrist parties will shift to the right on climate policy to cover their electoral flanks, much in the way that the Conservative Party has done in the UK to cover themselves from UKIP? So what do they need to do to maintain their electoral strength while keeping momentum on climate policy?
I think there is the risk. If you look at what happened, particularly in Germany, but I think in the discourse across Europe on migration policy, we saw that there is a shift from both conservative, liberal, social democratic parties to become much more conservative, and the entire political system and debate moved towards the right. Is that something that can happen on the climate discourse? Maybe, because I think the arguments that are put forward by right-wing populists that climate measures are affecting domestic economy and is a particular burden for low-income households, it's a fair argument. And many of the Social Democrats make the same argument. Many of the conservative Democratic parties make the same argument. So what's the conclusion? I mean, one thing is they do not want to be put into the same pot with right-wing populists. And I think what we observe at the moment of, you know, conservative parties trying to push Fidesz out of their parliamentary group is one indication there. But I think that's the challenge for the Democratic parties, to develop their own narrative that resonates among a larger part of the population without just copying the arguments that right-wing populists put forward, even though many of the Democratic parties would at that point argue the same way, but for other motives.
The report ends with many recommendations that centrist parties could actually pick up on and put forward a more positive message around climate policy. Stella, could you explain some of the recommendations that come out of the report?
Well, in attacking progressive policies such as climate policy, nationalist parties really misinterpreted the problem, because inequality in Europe is real, but the cause is not really progressiveness or progressive policies, but rather divisive neoliberal economic policies that treat competition as the fundamental defining characteristic of human relations. And what we recommend here really is that we shouldn't engage in isolated policies that may disproportionately affect poorer citizens and sometimes do harm the environment, but that we need a holistic climate policy and climate communication. So firstly, we should hear the populists' criticism and understand their origins. We must acknowledge that globalization and climate action may have unjust effects if they remain unmanaged, and that we need climate policy measures that are really embedded in wider social reforms and redistributive policies, and that we also need to communicate the benefits of climate action, that it will be very beneficial for our environment, for social justice, for the air quality in our lifestyles. And we need narratives that convey enthusiasm towards political change and a societal sustainable transformation.
So listening to that and reading the report, it strikes me as something quite similar to what the US Democratic Party is doing with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal. Do you see her as a test case for what you propose?
The Green New Deal in the US asks for nothing less than a complete overhaul of the society, creating new jobs, high quality education, et cetera, so it goes far beyond climate action. And I think on the one hand, it was criticized as a socialist project, and a lot of Americans said they want to take away our hamburgers. But on the other hand, it also stimulated a debate in the US, and people care or get much more informed about climate change, and about 70% in the US are really worried about climate action. So I think it was a very useful proposal that stimulated a countrywide debate. And it is, in my eyes, a litmus test for the recommendations.
Absolutely. I would agree. I mean, I would agree in substance. I disagree in terms of how we label the whole thing. So why, if you develop a comprehensive idea about the future of a society, and given that even in the US many people are concerned about their natural environment and well-being, why do you label it a Green New Deal? That's my only point, to say we need to be careful in how we conceptualize and sell things, because then people will jump on that. So what we have learned or observing at the moment in Germany, that obviously right-wing populists and social media, and they are very professional on using social media to shape positions in the public, they seem to move from looking at migration to focus on climate. And I think that is a risk itself, because on the one hand, we say you don't have a position yet. But if you form a position, we can assume that it's not a very progressive one. So I would, I just hesitate a little bit to whatever we do in terms of transformation of society. We do that on the basis of, you know, protecting planetary boundaries. And I'm saying this being an environmentalist and working and speaking on behalf of an think tank on environment and climate. But in terms of political communication, I would be much broader on that, because you need to have the powerhouses behind you. You need to have both socialist, social democrats, the liberal democrats, and the conservative party behind you. And I think that is a question of how you design that and how you sell that to a wider public. My big question is, if the equivalent to the Green New Deal in the US is going to be a European Green New Deal, or if that is going to be something else. And what I mean with that is that I think we need to combine in a smart way the idea of Europe that is built as an institution to bring about peace and prosperity, together with, in the light of the history of progressive environmental policy and also climate policies, what would be the narrative that combines these issues? And I doubt a little bit that it's the green of the deal. I think it needs to be a new deal. It needs to be a European deal. It needs to be a deal that is strong on language of increasing competitiveness, of modernizing a society by building on what makes Europe so unique, the kind of diversity of the very small European countries and culture that needs to be preserved, but also needs to be taken in the light of digitalization, urbanization trends, and trends to build resilient societies, but also resilient cities and municipalities. And I think, and if a Green New Deal in the US, as we see it right now, is framed as a new left liberal project. And I'm not 100% sure, if you look at the political landscape and the decline of socialist and social democratic parties here, if the green is the driver of what brings us into a European future. I think it should be a central element. So from a communication point of view, I think that we should think in alternatives, a European sustainable future that is concentrating a bit more on competitiveness, modernization, the just transition aspect, because that is crucial. I mean, in the end, everybody would agree we would like to live in the future, in a couple of decades from now, in an environment that's healthy. But I think apart from that, we saw that how vulnerable democracies are, and not because of climate. I mean, what we've seen all over Europe and with the emergence of right-wing populist parties is that we always believe that democracy is something that is just existing. But you need to live it, you need to develop it, you need to defend it. And I think so my interpretation of vulnerability is less to be climate vulnerable to climate change impacts, but you are very vulnerable to disruption in society. So I think the narrative that we should develop in Europe should go beyond the climate and the green.
Okay, I think that's a good place to end it. Thanks very much to both of you, and best of luck with the report.
Thank you, Martin.
And that was Stella Schaller and Alexander Karius of Adelphi. This has been the Climate Diplomacy Podcast with me, Martin Wall. I would like to thank the Irish Research Council and the European Commission for funding this podcast through their Caroline Fellowship. Until next time, goodbye.